It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. And I got stuck in Auckland last night, Marianne, on the night of the Occams. I wasn't there to go to them, but during the afternoon I went to the Auckland Art Gallery with my daughter and we bumped into Fergus Barrowman and Elizabeth Knox, his wife. And Fergus, of course, is the publisher of Te Heringa Waka Press, and I just wished them good luck. They were off to the Occams. He will be the most happy person today. I mean, I know this is going up next week, but today he will be, because three of his books won three of the major prizes. Yeah. And others, you know, were notable. Ingrid Horrocks's short stories won the fiction prize. Would have been a surprise, but a worthy winner of that. Nafanua Purcell-Kersell, I'm never quite sure how to pronounce those names, but she won for the poetry prize. And again, wonderful, because her poems are very original and a wonderful, stunning new voice. And of course, the non-fiction was won by Tina Makariti, who's, you know, has been known as a fiction writer, but these are a collection of essays about her, pretty autobiographical. So, you know, that was a pretty remarkable sweep of books.
I'm still with you on the floor of the art gallery, bumping into Elizabeth Knox and Fergus, because I just would be crazy fangirling at that stage. I'm reading Nightmare at the moment. So, amazing success for them. Really, yes. Cool. And we've got great interviews with Ingrid and
Nafanua
as well, haven't we? Mm. So we'll be re-upping those at some stage over the next few weeks. But this show is going to, whilst we congratulate all the Occam winners, of course, and Te Heringa Waka Press, this show is going to be focused on young adult authors and on three books that I've all of whom I've interviewed recently. We had Bob Kerr, he's a bit of a legend, and it was on his not quite a graphic novel, an illustrated YA history called The Takoradi Run, and it which I can't recommend highly enough. It's a great read, for especially for boys who find it hard, or all young readers who find it hard to engage in just full-on text, but there's a lot of feeling, a lot of good feeling in the book. And then we've got Daniel Devenny with Counting Down with Theodore Brown, a really interesting read, great premise, bright young new voice in YA fiction. And then we've got Maria Gill, who's written a historical novel called A Flame in the Dark about New Zealand Australia's most decorated war hero, who is also a spy. Great read. This week on Bookends, a young adult program with three authors, Bob Kerr, Daniel Devenny, and Maria Gill. Bob Kerr is an illustrator, artist, and author whose work has accumulated much acclaim and multiple awards over a career publishing since the early 80s. His middle reader novel, Terry and the Gunrunners, has twice been adopted for TV. His latest graphic novel, The Takoradi Run, and I'm going to get corrected on pronunciation there, no doubt, targets 11 to 15-year-olds who find chapter books with solid blocks of text daunting. Although Bob never patronises his readers, the emotional and political subtext of the book are blunt, provocative, and moving. While the action cracks along, the history informs, and the illustrations deepen all of those aspects of the reading experience. It's a book based closely on an untold and fascinating slice of Bob's family history that was a real pleasure to get to hear about as a reader. Thanks for bringing another piece of history alive, Bob. It's an honour to have you join us from your home. Tēnā koe and ngā mihi for the book.
Lovely to be here.
Yeah, thank you. So, okay, the hero of this book, he's actually a bit of an anti-hero in some ways, isn't he? Tell us about Ron and who he is to you.
Well, I only met Ron when he was in his 80s, and I was, I think it was the end of the 1990s. He'd been the person who was always not talked about in our family. You know, every family should have a sort of black sheep who the proper members of the family try to keep hidden. And we were a very proper family. You know, we had to be a nice middle class family in our nice middle class street with our nice middle class neighbours. And Ron was a bit of a party animal, and he was a bit of a lad on the make. And so I only really, and we knew the rules. We knew not to ask about him. We had to pretend he didn't exist. I don't know why. It was just silly. He was actually great fun, and I regret not meeting him earlier in his life. He was my mother's brother. And eventually I said to my mum, I think I'm going to go and meet Ron. Where does he live? Because we didn't know. And she said, in a flat in Blockhouse Bay in Auckland. Sorry, my phone's ringing. And off I went to Blockhouse Bay to find him. And the first thing he said when he opened the door was, Bob, I made a lot of money in the Second World War.
Did he know at this stage that you were an author, Bob? Was that...
No. And I knew that if I whipped out a tape recorder or a notebook and started scribbling down, I suspected he'd stopped talking. So I just sort of nodded, and he'd say 3 hours later, am I talking too much? And I'd say, no, you've got a lot to catch up on. But I could hear his voice in my head for a while afterwards, and I'd rush out to the car with my notebook and sit there and write it all down.
Fabulous. It is a great, gripping tale of his adventures. So just let me catch up there. Your mum was Sister Wynne?
Yes, that's right.
Lovely. So she's written into the story as well. But she grew up and married and didn't maintain contact with her brother.
I think Ron was not very good at writing letters or keeping in touch. Mum was good at secrets.
Right.
So between them, we had, you know, this rather constrained. We had this rather constrained view. Mm. And when I went to see Ron, he was not constrained at all. He was the best storyteller I've ever heard, actually.
Fabulous. So the name of the book, and please correct me, Takoradi Run, that gives the book its title. Tell listeners about just exactly what we're talking about there.
The Takoradi Run was a delivery route for planes. Ron had trained at Ohakia, joined the Air Force, dashed off to have a good time and hoped Mr. Hitler wouldn't stop the war before he got there to sort it out. Like many of those jokers, he bombed Germany and survived, and then he was assigned to Takoradi. He didn't know where Takoradi was. It was in Africa. It's a place that was then called the Gold Coast and is now called Ghana. And because they couldn't fly aeroplanes across the Mediterranean to Cairo to help defeat Rommel, they had this long, convoluted way of getting them there. They'd shift them round to Takoradi, a port in Ghana, to a big factory, build them up, and then fly them across the Sahara Desert in five hops. And Ron was told, look, it's easy. Just follow the planes that have crashed in the desert. You'll find your way. It was quite hazardous. But for a couple of years, he just flew round and round and round, delivering these they delivered about 5,000 planes.
Yeah. And so whose
job? To fly the Brennan bomber.
Yeah.
And the Hurricane fighters would follow him. He had a radio, and the Hurricanes didn't. And so he learned all about sandstorms and snakes and...
And all of the action which is entailed in that story is illustrated beautifully and told in the novel. There's a lot in the early book, and you've hinted it in your own family story there, Bob, so much about Ron's relationship with his old man, then with his friends, his moral compass. Yeah. It all speaks to a very specific kind of growing up experience for boys in Aotearoa, doesn't it? Aspects that feel very real to the era, but I'm interested to know the extent to which you think young male readers today will still identify with all those kinds of issues.
Well, I hope they do, and I'm so glad you've noticed that, because it's really of interest to me. I think a good book can provide a roadmap for a young male in this case, or a young woman in other cases, to get on. This is how you could lead your life. Now, Ron was an interestingly complex person. He didn't seem to get on with his dad terribly much. He couldn't wait to leave home. We all face that. I mean, I'm just coming out of my adolescence myself, you know. Still try to work it out. I work these things out often by writing books.
Well, you've written enough of them, for goodness sake. I think that's right. I think that the kind of male identity and almost a kind of a young man who's about action, right, rather than about words. He's grown up without a lot of kind of careful emotional care.
Yeah.
And he's all about action. For boys like that, that you're saying, you think you can still find a way, you can live a full and busy life and still find a way. Mm. Yeah.
I learned this actually, if I can talk about another book briefly. I've just been reading, I read it to my son, and now I've been reading it to my grandson. Well, a few years ago, he's moved on now. A book by called Hatchet by Gary Paulson. It sold resilience because it's a really good book. And it's a book about a boy who crashes a plane in the northern Canadian forest and has to live on his own for over a year with just a hatchet. That's all he's got.
Yeah, and I'm familiar with
my grandson read it three times himself, and then we had to read it twice out loud to him. Because, every boy knows that he's going to be abandoned in the forest with just a hatchet, don't they?
Well,
these boys are looking for, boys and, or are boys, boys from 8 to 80, are always looking for roadmaps. How do we do this? Books and films can provide that.
Fantastic. One of the things is that you use New Zealand history. It supplies a heap of your content generally. So just moving away from this book specifically. And this story kind of landed with you. But generally, how do you go about finding and researching your subjects? Because
haphazardly and by accident.
Okay.
I hear a good story, like Ron, you know. I thought, my goodness, this is an unknown story. I've got to find out more. So I actually went to Takoradi. I hopped on a plane with my partner and my son, and we went there because I know that if I go to a place, I'll find out more than I can ever imagine. You can scoot around on the internet and read books, but if you go to the place, and so we went there, and we had tremendous good luck. We engaged a driver called Francis, and he was just fantastic. And Ghana, I mean, you know, if I can be the Ghana tourist board for a minute, go to Ghana. It's great. Fantastic music, fantastic food. It's a bit rough and ready, but a great place. I'd go back at the drop of a hat. Anyway, Francis said, "Why are you here?" And we said, "Well, I'm writing a book about my uncle." And he was a gold smuggler. And Francis said, "You'll need to go to a gold mine then." And he took us to an illegal gold mine. You know, he had contacted Francis.
You get the sense that half of Ghana and half of Kaido have contacts, don't you?
Yes, that's right.
It reads that way in the story.
Well, they went to Cairo too.
Yes, and all of that's very vivid and very beautiful in the story, beautifully illustrated. It does make me think, though, that there are politics and moral issues, and you talk about the illegal gold mine. There are politics and moral issues that are complicated, right, in writing this story out there. Times and attitudes have changed. Yeah. Other things like honesty haven't changed, but you give your readers a lot of credit to form all their own positions on moral issues. I'm really interested in your philosophy, basically, your take on creating moral dilemmas for young readers in today's world, you know.
So I really think that young readers are sophisticated, usually. They might not be able to put everything in words, but they want to know these things. They want to know about moral dilemmas. Like Ron arrives in Takoradi just as the British Empire is falling to pieces. After that, it became Ghana, an independent country led by Kwame Nkrumah. And so he's there at the end of empire. He probably didn't notice all this, but I think it's very interesting. So I try to layer that into the story, and I try to layer in his you used the word moral compass, and I think that's a good word. He develops a sort of moral compass, maybe.
Yeah.
He starts to think about it as a result of his experiences.
I'm interested to know how much of that's kind of the Ron that you met and how much of that's you as an author navigating this territory for readers.
I'm not sure that I can say where to move that slider, you know. I'm still trying to develop my own moral compass, you know.
I guess you give Ron, the things that I noticed were you give him curiosity and instinctive kind of humanitarian morality, and also quite a cultural naivety, but open, you know, with that curiosity. And those are very good characteristics to help you kind of navigate the change in attitudes between then and now, aren't they?
Yes.
I guess my when I was reading it, I was wondering, do you do that really consciously? Was that actually Ron's character art? So you met a man who thought about the world differently, or is it something that you're doing deliberately because it's sensitive writing these issues for kids today?
Because I met Ron very few times, I had to take liberties and put in what I thought he may have been thinking. And it gets tangled up with what I'm thinking. And it gets tangled up with what is a good story. You know, often history is just our lives are just random events, one after the other. And stories have beginnings, middles, ends, and nice, tidy resolutions. So I probably tidied Ron's story up into a nice three-act structure and all that stuff, hoping to remain true to his intent, you know, to invent a few things, to make it work.
Look, we are going to run out of time, Bob.
What a pity.
I know, because there is so much to talk about that all of that history of war and in that region feels so relevant today.
It is. There's still a war going on about gold in the Sahara,
in the
Sudan. It's an unreported war, and it's brutal, much more brutal than the Takoradi run that Ron was involved in. But that's another entire story.
Another entire story.
I'm glad that there are so many more stories to tell because you tell them and illustrate them so beautifully. Thank you so much for joining us. The book is The Takoradi Run. It's written and illustrated by Bob Kerr. He's a legend, look him up, and published by Bateman Books. It's available everywhere from booksellers nationwide. Thank you.
Lovely. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, Bob. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kaki.
Thanks.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
A Flame in the Dark is the dramatised true story of one of the most decorated war heroes of the French Resistance, Nancy Wake. Nancy's story is retold here by author Maria Gill for a young adult audience. Born in Aotearoa of Māori heritage, Nancy lived most of her life outside of her war years in Australia. She's an historical, an astonishing historical figure of bravery, and it is wonderful to have her story told in such an engaging way for a new generation, a new audience. Maria joins me this morning to talk about her book. Tēnā koe, thanks for coming on the show.
Kia ora, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. Where are you talking to us from, Maria? Where's home for you?
Point Wells, and if people don't know where that is, it's somewhere near Warkworth, a little seaside village north of Auckland.
Lovely, lovely. So, Maria, when did you first hear about Nancy? How long has she been part of your imagination? And how did you come to write her story?
Well, back in 2015, I wrote another Anzac book called Anzac Heroes, and I included Nancy Wake in that. And I hadn't been aware of her Māori heritage before that, but the picture that Marco Vancic drew of her, I thought, oh my gosh, she looks like she's got Māori heritage. And so I did more research on her, and I thought, you know, this book would be, it would be such a great story for young people. And so it kept in my mind. And then I thought, oh, you know what, I'll do a master's in creative writing and that'll be my thesis, because I'd written a lot of children's nonfiction, around about 60 of them. But I wanted guidance for a longer form of story. And so I did that for my master's. But over the last 5 years, I've been editing it because I had been a nonfiction writer. I tended to be all about plot. And so I had to really get into her character. And also because I was writing it in New Zealand, I was using the internet a lot, you know, maps and everything, just to see where things were so that I could say, you know, give description of setting. But it really made me want to go to all the places that she'd been to. I really wanted to see it for myself. So last year in April, I met up with my son, who was in the Navy, and his Irish girlfriend. And we went to a lot of the places where Nancy was based, but the main thing we did was her incredible 600K bike ride. Now, we only did half of it, and she did that 600K ride in 3 days. We did half, only one way, and it took us 5 days. And some days we were traveling 9 hours a day. We thought, when you look at Google Maps, you think it's going to be a road, but in France, it can quite often be a paddock, a farm track, some muddy lane. And so that's why it took us so long to get to the places we want. But, oh, my gosh, it really gave me a huge respect for Nancy. I mean, I was already in awe of her as a spy and resistance fighter, but how she did that on her own in a dangerous time, I was blown away. In fact, I said my son, he was not impressed because he had thought this was going to be a joyful ride in the French countryside, and here we were riding in the rain for 9 hours flat. And but he said, you know what? If you're in a wartime and people rely on you, you draw on those reserves. So he could understand how she could have done that, and could see, you know, that could happen to him in the future in the situation. So, yeah, and I came home, and I, even though I'd done quite a few drafts by then, I was able to enrich the story more with the, you know, of the places that she'd been to.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, that story, that one episode. But I just wonder if before we go any further, you could just sketch for listeners what Nancy managed to achieve with her time with the in her time with the resistance. Well, just what her role was, and how much she achieved for the resistance.
Well, how she was different to a lot of other spies. A lot of them were dropped into France in 1944, and they'd be there for several months. She was actually fighting against the Nazis right from the get-go. As soon as, even before they invaded France, she was an ambulance driver ferrying wounded French soldiers or the refugees to a hospital. And then as soon as she got back from that, you know, she knew that she wanted to do something and came across some people. The first one was a French resistance man, and she started couriering messages. And then she came across some British downed airmen, and they had set up an underground to get airmen out of the country. And so she started to help with that. And one of them actually got caught, and she helped him escape from one of the prisons. So she was, you know, doing a lot of work in those first few years. But, of course, then the Nazis, they realised that there was a woman getting the Jewish, helping them escape into the Pyrenees Mountains and downed airmen. And so they put a wanted message out to all their, you know, their Gestapo, saying they want to catch this woman. They called her the White Mouse because she was obviously difficult to catch. And so she realised she had to leave. And six times she tried to leave the country. She actually got caught by the French, at one stage, the French police, and was held captive with them for 3 days, not fed and beaten up. And she managed to escape from there. She actually was able to walk out of that one through some lies that they were able to tell. But she jumped off a railway that was in motion, but eventually got through the Pyrenees Mountains, got captured by the Spanish police and had to talk her way out of that. And then she finally gets to England, and most people would have felt they had done enough of the war. Not Nancy Wake. She says, drop me back in. I will do anything to help. And so they trained her as a spy for 6 months and flew her back into the Avignon region. And from there, she was then the person who she would drive around to all of the different marquee groups. I think there was around about 15 of them, and there were around about 7,000 when she started. And her job was to find out what they needed: arms, food, clothing, money. And so she also became the leader of that group, and would get them to do training on weapons. She would get them to have escape plans, and then tell them, you know, what factories they needed to blow up, so that they could stop the Germans from getting to the Normandy coast, which is where the Americans and the British and the Canadians were landing.
It's extraordinary, to think of the impact of one woman in those dark times of history. Which part of all of that action did you find the most frightening to contemplate when you're recreating it and dramatizing it in this version and trying to get inside Nancy's head? Which one of those stories did you find was perhaps the most frightening and the most kind of highly dramatic and tense to try and imagine yourself into?
Well, I thought the bike ride was, you know, like, that was incredible. And some of the lengths of travel, I don't even know how she did it and the amount of time she did. But there was also the incident of where they stormed the factory and she actually gets knifed by a bayonet. And that, to me, that was a very tense moment because she's crawling through scrub. And then there was a period where there was no grass or any bushes or anything for her to hide. She had to stand up and run towards the guard and make him unconscious. That was their goal. But he turned, she crunched on a stone with a foot, and he turned just as she got there. And so she had no choice. She'd been told, if they spot you, you'll have to silently kill them. And when she was doing the spy training, she had been taught how to use her hand across the windpipe to actually kill them. And she, I think she need him at the same time. And so he dies, but his bayonet slices her as he falls down. And to me, that was such a tense moment. The creeping up and then being spotted and that quick action to silence him and also having to hold her arm because it was bleeding and getting away from the scene and then, you know, seeing it blowing up as they're driving away. So it was actually quite a few incidents like that that I thought, wow.
Wow, exactly. And reading them when you know it, because when you're researching a life like Nancy who survived the war and many of the people who she worked alongside, fought alongside in the resistance, also survive. And there's great documented record of a lot of her, a lot of these events. So you're not making these things up. You're dramatizing them for us as a reader, but actually they're based on fact, aren't they? And it makes reading them feel completely different than just if they're fictional. Imagining this brave, principled woman putting herself in this situation over and over again.
Yes, absolutely.
I wonder what you want young readers to take out of a reading of this story today.
Well, I mean, it's also about resilience. I don't hide the fact that there's around about three times during World War II where she, you know, she sort of collapses in herself. She stays in bed, she's crying. Three times it's because of her husband, whether she's not sure whether he's died. In fact, she thinks she has a dream the second time that he has died, and she's so sure of it. And she's devastated, you know, with all the what she'd gone through in France and the fear and the running and everything. And those, so I wanted to show those. A lot of people have just glossed over those periods, but because everyone, if you're going through that much stressful time, you're of course going to, you know, have periods of where you're not coping. And so I wanted to show that, you know, she had those moments, but she was able to pull herself together, and she was really resilient and able to carry on. And so that's what I want young readers to understand, is you can sometimes do go through tough times and have grief and sadness, but you can pull yourself together and carry on. And I think that's a really important message for young people to realise.
Mm. Nancy survived and lived a great life after the war, even after she lost her husband, but remarried. And did she engage much as a war hero with youth, and did she have any messages herself for young people that you
I
came
don't
across?
No, if she, because she never had any children of her own. She gave a lot of, I think she gave a lot of speeches at sort of RSA or the equivalent in Australia, but I don't think there was any time that she gave talks or messages for young people. And that's why I thought, you know, like, this is really overdue. No young adult book has been written about her. In fact, no New Zealander had written about her before, and that's why I wanted to bring in her Māori heritage, because there's one fictional element I bring into the story about her real-life grandmother, Māori grandmother, giving her a pounamu that her mother had given her, and it was to give her strength and, you know, if in times where she will need it. And so I draw on that talisman throughout the story, and it's sort of a reminder of her Māori heritage throughout the book, and also the saying, kia kaha, be strong, and she repeats that to herself when she's really at the lowest ebb of her energy when she's doing that bike ride. And I think those are two important words that I think in New Zealand vocab now, you know, be brave, be strong. And so I was really, you know, pleased that I included that in the story.
Mm, and Nancy herself spoke about that, and you know, there's such rich heritage of the Māori Battalion, of course, from the First World War, but the, of Māori fighting in those wars on behalf of their allies, and Nancy, you connecting Nancy's story to that, I think, works very well for the narrative. Almost at our time. I guess one of the things that Nancy was a bit of a renegade as a youngster, wasn't she? And this is a book for young people. What do you think Nancy would have got up to if she hadn't had a war to give her the purpose? What do you think she'd be getting up to if she were one of your young readers today?
Yes, I think she would have been a real rebel. And I think that's why she never really fitted in after World War II. I think she was quite lost. And maybe that contributed to her being such a big drinker. I'd say she had a drinking problem. And that's why I start the story of when she's 16 and runs away from home and hides under her her stepsister's house. And so I wanted to show that she had that rebellious side to her, and that she was, you know, a little bit one of these, you know, reckless. In fact, at the beginning, one of the resistance leaders actually said to her that they think she's too reckless. And so that's one thing I get her to resolve throughout the story. And also the fact that she didn't get on with her mum. Her mum was probably very stressed by the fact that her husband had left them when Nancy was 6 years of age. And Nancy was 10 years younger than all the other siblings. And so she was left with this young daughter on her own. Her husband sold the house under them. And so I think a lot of the resentment her mother had was put onto Nancy, and that's why she runs away from home. And, you know, some kids would identify with that. But I also get her to resolve that anger she has towards her mother, especially when she's afraid that her husband is missing.
Mm.
And
So the growing up parts here are really important in the story, aren't they? And I guess I just felt like there's a bit of a message there, even for kids who find it hard to find their place. That some of the people who make the biggest difference in the world have been kids who have found it hard to make their place. So thank you so much for joining us and for sharing Nancy's story with us. The book is A Flame in the Dark, an account of the story of decorated war hero Nancy Wake, who fought with the French resistance during the Second World War. It's authored by Maria Gill. It's published by One Tree House and available at bookstores nationwide.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Counting Down with Theodore Brown is the debut novel for 14 to 18-year-olds by author Daniel Devenny. Despite his Northern Irish brogue, Daniel has earned his slot on an Aotearoa Book Lovers podcast by virtue of 10 years as a passionate bookseller on these shores, and the fact that he is now firmly ensconced in Tamaki Makaurau. It's always very cool for us at Bookends to speak to debut authors. Tēnā koe, Daniel. And How are you enjoying this crazy ride, releasing Theo to the big bad world?
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's still surreal. I keep thinking at each point that I reach, it's going to hit home and feel real, but it's still, I'm still waiting for that moment to arrive. I thought once I held the book in my hands and I saw it in a store, I'd be like, okay, this is happening, but it still feels like a bit of a dream.
Yeah, well, being a book lover, has it always been in your sights to write, and specifically for this target audience, or what's your journey been to up to this point where you are holding interviews about your debut novel?
Yeah, I had sort of a, how would you put it? It took me a while to kind of realize I was always into storytelling, and I knew that would be a part of whatever I did. But it took me a while to figure out that books would be the right medium. In school, I was always really good at art. So I was into drawing and painting. And then I was also good at music and English, and everything else I was pretty terrible at. But anything creative, I could kind of find my footing. But yeah, it started with music. That's what I thought I wanted to do. But it was, when I look back now, I can always see the thread was the storytelling. Because with music, it was the songwriting. That was the part that really drew me to it. And the part that drew me to musicians was the storytelling aspect. And then with art as well, which was the second thing that I thought, I sort of took a dive from music because I realized I didn't really like being front and center. I was always in competitive choir, so I had trophies and I got a gold medal for a solo once. But whenever the focus was just on me or I was in front of a camera, I didn't feel that comfortable. The confidence wasn't there, and I wasn't sure if, I realized I was more of, I'd prefer to be behind the scenes, like writing the songs. And then with art, it was kind of similar. I had the talent for painting and drawing, but it was more about what I was trying to say, like what was the story behind the painting or the story behind the drawing. So I don't know why it took me so long to figure it out, because
because drawing's not nearly such a good medium for that as,
yeah,
you know, it's harder, much harder to portray a whole story that communicates directly to the audience, isn't it? Although, so that's interesting that it did take you so long to get to writing, especially when with Theo, we have a story which demonstrates your talents really beautifully. It's a love story, okay, and it's it's got this one central critical device, and it's in the publicity notes, so I don't think it's giving away too much to talk about Theo's gift, is it? Can you tell the readers about it, and also how you came up with that?
Yeah, of course. So it's a coming-of-age love story, but with a major twist. Theodore is an introverted, nerdy college student, but with a unique ability, as you said. When he looks into a person's eyes, he sees a number representing the exact number of days he'll spend with that person. Naturally, this has messed with his head and affected all of his relationships, so he mostly keeps to himself until he meets someone incredibly special and decides to throw caution to the wind. The idea came from a very personal place. It came to me after I applied for my New Zealand residency, when I found myself questioning whether I could live so far away from my loved ones in Ireland. And I was really torn because I'd fallen in love with Aotearoa, but I couldn't stop thinking about how many days I'd have left with my family and friends at home if I did choose to stay. And I asked myself if I'd make the same decision if I knew those exact numbers. And Theodore Brown was sort of just born from there. I've always had a deep interest in psychology, and I quickly became fascinated by how that kind of ability would shape a person and sort of affect every area of their life.
Oh, that's a beautiful backstory for that. I saw it as a very neat metaphor for the way that people who have experienced traumatic loss as children might never really trust the reliability of any loving relationship again. So it has that kind of position in the plot in Theo. So it's interesting to know the backstory that you give it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're writing about love, and it's a deeply romantic book. You obviously believe there's still a hunger for that kind of connected, soulful relationship that you portray. So what do you say to people who tell us that this generation of readers are our most cynical ever?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think when you talk to people, you do get a sense of that, in a sense that almost sincerity or romance in a way has kind of been replaced with apathy and sort of pessimism. But at the same time, if you look at the books that are really like popping off and going nuts at the minute, it's the whole like romanticy thing. Or yeah, I think at the root of most books that tend to, you know, fly off the shelves, there is some kind of love story at the heart of it. And I think it's love, whether it be platonic for, you know, our friends or family or romance, I think it is at the heart of life. It's at the heart of everything. And I think whether we admit it or not, we're all searching for some kind of connection, something that's, you know, deep and real and pure. I think we all just want something to believe in. And I hope that this story, you know, young people will read it and see that it is worth it. And yes, it involves risk, it's scary, it's, you know, many things, but I think it is always worth it. Whether the relationship lasts or not, it's worth it.
That as the message of the book is, it comes through really strongly. It's a wholesome and generous book, but it isn't shy of dark themes, mental health specifically. Were you nervous tackling issues of depression and suicide? And also, how hard was it to find an authentic way through Theo's struggles to hopefulness in the book?
Yeah, I definitely was nervous about that. And those heavy chapters were the ones that I drafted the most. You know, I rewrote. It was really important to get it right, particularly because I am writing for, you know, a young adult audience. So I needed to be sure that the messaging and everything was correct. And I knew it would always be a hopeful story and it would always have more light than dark, but I couldn't authentically, because yes, it's a love story, but at the heart of it, sort of what sparked it for me was a story about communication and connection, and how important it is that young people do talk, because the biggest side effect of shutting down and not talking can be fatal. And so I couldn't tell a story about communication authentically without talking about the worst side effect that not doing that. So yeah, I put a lot of thought into it, and there was actually a draft of the book where I had cut out a certain chapter, but it didn't feel as authentic. I felt like I was not being brave enough. And so, yeah, I sort of kept working at it and working it until I was happy enough. And said just enough, but, you know, didn't go too dark or lean too heavily into those things, but without avoiding them.
Yeah. No, I think it's very skillful in that. And one of the things that occurs to me is I was kind of intrigued by the book's setting. It's distinctive culturally in ways that really shape the story. And the place of therapy in particular is quite culturally distinctive to the States where you've seen it. You know, less so in other cultures, perhaps, you know. So Theo has a relationship with a really, really helpful, positive other adult in his life, a therapy relationship. Tell me about choosing America and that whole kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's a bit of a story behind that as well. So when I originally sat down and like plotted the entire story and did the outline, I was trying to think where I would set it, because I was a bit nervous about setting it from my hometown because it's so specific and the way we talk is so specific. So I decided to have it be a generic town that could be anywhere in the world. But then early on, the whole road trip aspect came to mind, and I really wanted to end it with something big. And as soon as Dollywood entered my brain, it sort of changed the trajectory of the story, because it just made so much sense, because music's such a big part of the story, and it just, I couldn't shake the idea of the trip to Dollywood. And so
because of where it sits in the story, but that is Dolly Parton. That gives us a beautiful segue to Dolly, and I've already appreciated your t-shirt. she's a muse for you and for Theo as well. Tell us about who she represents for Theo.
I think Dolly in general for people seems to represent light and hope and goodness. And she's such an amazing storyteller. Like her songs are some of the best examples of, you know, what a great lyricist can do. Code of Many Colors, for example, which has been adapted into a children's picture book, like it is just a fully formed story. And also she's just got, you know, the most beautiful background of, you know, being so working class, hardworking. She's a hero to me, but I'm kind of your stereotypical gay, where all of the big divas were my idols. So Dolly, Cher, Whitney, Tina, Cyndi Lauper, Kate Bush, all of them. Like I grew up adoring them and seeing their strength, and no matter how the media or the world attacked them, they just rose above and they never like dimmed their shine for anybody. And I think as a queer person, that's maybe why we idolize figures like that. And I think women in general, we have such an appreciation for women because they're attacked in very similar ways that, you know, gay men are attacked growing up.
Mm, yeah. No, I think that that's beautifully said, and thank you for that. I guess it does lead on to the next question. Your values shine through in the way that this book deals with themes of love, sexuality, community. And I guess I wonder how hard you think it might be for adolescents today to develop healthy perspectives on those big issues.
Yeah, I think it's tricky because young people have access to everything just in the palm of their hands now. And some ways that can be a great benefit, but in other ways it can really send you down some dark rabbit holes. So yeah, I don't know if it's easier for young people today or harder, you know, with technology and social media and everything being how it is. I really can't distinguish. But what I will say is I'm glad that I sort of came of age and grew up when I did, when it wasn't. It is a worry, but I guess that's down to the individual to kind of, you know, use the tools that we have now in a healthy way.
I think beautiful books can be such a guide for us in when we're young, can't they? Like they kind of give us a place to escape to, but they also maybe provide us with a bit of a guide. If you were to think about the key books that shaped you as a young reader, as a young man finding your way, can you come up with any titles?
The big one for me, and people are probably sick of me talking about it, is The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky. That book did change my life. I've read it multiple times, and each time I read it, I manage to find something new or take something different away from it. And it's meant different things to me at different periods of my life. And I think when I first came to it, the thing that really stuck with me was a line, which was, "We accept the love we think we deserve." And that just changed my brain chemistry. And I reevaluated every relationship I'd ever had. And it's a lesson that, it's one of those things that's easier said than done. I have to remind myself of it. And I've had periods in my life where I have had to remind myself of that lesson. Mm. But yeah, that's definitely...
The lessons of being a wallflower, is that it?
The perks of being a wallflower.
Perks of being a wallflower.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. That's so listeners, there you have it. The writing that inspires beautiful writing. And so, Daniel, thank you very much for joining us. I think I've called Theo a couple of times in the interview. Excuse that. You probably get that more than is reasonable. But thank you very much for joining us. The book is Counting Down with Theodore Brown. It's by Daniel Devaney.
But I guess there's an Devaney. Accent element to it as well.
An accent. So can you just, Nico, just put a marker in there, and I'm going to do the wrap again. So the book is Counting Down with Theodore Brown by Daniel Devaney, published by Allen & Unwin. It's available in stores nationwide. Thank you so much for joining us, Daniel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ka kite anō.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.